Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West. In a moment, the shockwaves over proposals to upend centuries of Catholic doctrine and practice by compelling priests to break the secrecy of the confessional. But we begin today with another story that will shake the confidence of Australian Catholics, those who've been hoping and praying their church was ready and willing to change in the aftermath of the sexual abuse scandal. Elizabeth Proust is one of Australia's most respected business leaders. She's chair of the Bank of Melbourne and Nestlé Australia, former CEO of the City of Melbourne. She knows a thing or two about running big organisations and fixing problems. So she was a natural pick to help oversee the Truth, Justice and Healing Council, which was set up to coordinate the church's response to the Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission. Elizabeth Proust is deputy chair of that council. But at a recent conference organised by the Broken Bay Institute, a Catholic theological college, Elizabeth Proust told me she had grave fears for vital reform in the church.
I think in the response so far from the church hierarchy, noting that that's not, of course, the whole church, it's been like the response to the initial abuse, too little, too late, a lack of heartfelt apology. And I fear that there's a view that once the Royal Commission reports and the publicity around what will be a fairly dire report, once that all dies down, that life will go back to what it was. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I'd like to think that the possibility for real transformation of the church exists, but it's an institution that's been very slow to change on a whole range of issues.
At the beginning of the Royal Commission, I recall speaking with a Catholic priest and commentator, and I asked whether he thought the bishops would see this simply as a cleansing fire, that once we get through it, the church will be cleansed but unreconstructed. I get the impression that's your fear too.
Partially cleansed and unreconstructed, I think.
Only partially cleansed, that's...
I think not a lot has really changed. About 3 or 4 months ago in the Weekend Australian, there was a really significant article about the responses of some of the clergy to, in particular, the CEO of the Truth, Justice and Healing Council, Francis Sullivan, almost seeing him as leading some kind of personal crusade, whereas what he and the council have been doing is acting on behalf of the church, both appearing before the Royal Commission, dealing with victims and dealing with what needs to change as a result of it. And I was quite disheartened by that article because it seemed to me that at least for a number of the clergy, there's not really been any change and they really are waiting out the commission so that life can return to what it was.
Yes, the tenor of that article, I should remind listeners, involved speaking to a dissident priest who effectively thought that the Royal Commission had been an attack on the church, an attack on church freedom. Elizabeth, is your fear or your trepidation about the failure to change rooted in the idea that the Catholic Church remains at its leadership an all-boys club?
I think that's part of it. I think the fact that women, whether they're religious or lay people, have still a reasonably insignificant role in the church. But in addition to that, what we have in terms of the governance of the church is at least a medieval structure. Most institutions today, including in the private sector where I work, have gone through very fundamental reforms. Very little has changed in church governance. In the rest of society, you don't generally see all male structures. And in fact, when you do see them, society calls it out today to say, how can you have a board, for example, of a corporation with no women on it? How can you have a board which has nobody from a different cultural background on it? But none of that thinking has permeated the Catholic Church in any form.
When we look at the most recent release of statistics from the Royal Commission, a stunning figure, 4,445 victims who were compensated or had lodged claims with the Catholic Church. And then we saw some stunning figures, some orders where 40% of the members had been accused of sexual abuse. What does that say about, if you like, the overwhelming male culture? Because overwhelmingly, they were in male-run religious orders, these crises and problems.
They were in male religious orders. And what I think it says is about a culture which is largely gone of taking young boys at a very early age away from their families, putting them through seminaries and the like with no female influence and no female contact, living or at least being supposed to live a celibate life, which is reasonably unusual. It is, if we think about it from the perspective not only of today but of the previous century, a pretty unusual way to live. And in retrospect, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that this happened. I think the other issue at work was a failure to speak up.
You have run a city, you have run a government department, you've run organisations in the private sector. Does the Catholic leadership listen to someone like you?
I think not just me, but the people on the council, which is by far the majority of lay people, not bishops or religious. We have been listened to, and the submissions that we have made to the Royal Commission as a council on behalf of the church, I think, have been effective and have been hard-hitting. Whether there's been real listening and real change, we'll probably need to wait and see until the response to the Royal Commission. But I remain pessimistic that the hierarchy, at least in this country, actually thinks that there really is a role for lay people.
What have they said and what have they done that provokes this continuing pessimism?
It's the failure to change. If I was presiding over an institution, Commonwealth Bank is going through this today, if I was presiding over an institution where there was a real scandal, fraud, sexual abuse, whatever, you would have a thorough investigation by independent people of the problem, and you would start to say, we have a problem with our culture, we have a problem with our systems, we have a problem with our processes. To give the church hierarchy their credit, they set up the council, they put a majority of lay people on it. So perhaps I'm being unduly pessimistic too early, but from my perspective, I don't see any sign that the lessons have been truly learnt to the point where the institution of the church is being questioned by those who've got the ability to change it.
We saw recently the resignation from the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Children and Young People of Marie Collins. Mm. Now, the resignation of such a credible person, a victim, herself a survivor representative, sent out a very negative message. What message did you, as someone who is grappling with this sexual abuse crisis, get from her decision to walk away, having been appointed and embraced by Pope Francis?
For me, it was a lesson or a message about the enormous problem that the Pope faces and that we all face of making any real changes in the Vatican bureaucracy.
What will real change look like then, giving women in the Catholic Church, who are, after all, I think something like 60% of the people in the pews, what would real change look like?
Real change would look like participation and active involvement. I think people will look to the 2020 Synod to see whether there are any signals that the Church is serious about equal participation of women. The ordination of women is definitely not in my lifetime issue. It will come, or else the Church will continue to fade and in some cases disappear altogether.
Maybe not ordination of women, Elizabeth, but people have talked about the former Irish President Mary McAleese being appointed as the head of a Roman dicastery, that is a Vatican department, other high-profile nuns running really seriously powerful organisations within the Vatican. Is that something that you could envisage?
Absolutely. That might then start to make a difference to how bishops are appointed and maybe even elected. But I think that the steps towards these changes are so slow and the inertia is so great. There's a level of pessimism, not just in myself, but in many other Catholics about this.
Elizabeth Proust, business leader and deputy chair of the Truth, Justice and Healing Council. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. If Elizabeth Proust's comments aren't enough of a shock to the system for Catholic leaders, the Royal Commission's recommendation this week was huge, a tectonic shift. The Commission says that priests who hear confessions from people who have abused children should be compelled, by law, to report the offender to police. This means breaking the seal of the confessional. It would overturn centuries of church law and practice because any priest who violates the secrecy is subject to immediate excommunication from the church. But there are, or have been, exceptions to the rule. Professor Des Carle of RMIT is a psychologist and one of Australia's leading experts on Catholic life. He was an advisor to the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry into Church Sexual Abuse and in 2015 an advisor to the Royal Commission.
Well, this was not unexpected, and it certainly wasn't unexpected to the Catholic bishops of Australia, because there had been signs emanating from Judge Peter McClelland and the Commission that because of the evidence of the misuse of confession before them in talking to victims, that the issue had to be addressed. And so the recommendations have come out in this very long report.
You've referred there to the Royal Commission and its concerns about the misuse of confession, and it does say that in its report, but do we know how widespread this practice might be of sexual predators making a confession and then going on to reoffend, comfortable in the knowledge of forgiveness?
I don't think we'll ever be able to quantify this, but I think we need to understand that a parallel catastrophe for the church has been the solicitation of women and children through the confessional process. It goes back many, many centuries. The confessional box was brought in order to try and prevent it, but it was always kept secret and hidden. The files of the Spanish Inquisition are full of cases of solicitation through the confessional. Then in 1910, Pope Pius X decreed that children as young as seven with the age of reason could receive the sacrament of penance, now known as reconciliation. Whereas prior to that, it had been just before puberty. And then, 12 years later in 1922, you have the decree, the crime of solicitation.
And by this, just to clarify, Des, you're talking about the priest using confession to prey on the vulnerable person making the confession.
That's right. And through the process of lowering the age, you then had vulnerable children who were coming to confession, and the priest could identify and then begin the process of grooming the person, usually outside the confessional. Now, this highlights that throughout the 20th century, the Holy See was aware of this issue of not just of soliciting in the confessional. It talks about that in the document, but at the end it mentions things like homosexuality of the clergy plus child sex abuse and bestiality. And as well as that, there were right throughout the 20th century statements, particularly by popes and the various congregations, about the behaviour and the misconduct of priests. So it was an ongoing issue. And Thomas Doyle, who you may recall...
Indeed, a guest on this program.
Yes, and who gave evidence to the Royal Commission. There he was in 1984, sitting in the Apostolic Nuncio in Washington, and he's noticing all these cases that are coming across his desk. So he writes a report, and he's able to get a cardinal to give it to Pope John Paul II. And so he's waiting for a reaction, and nothing happens.
Yeah.
Now, our argument would be that the Vatican already knew about it right throughout the 20th century and going back.
Yeah. So given that background, how much of a challenge then is the Royal Commission's recommendation that priests be required under pain of law and punishment that they report any confession of sexual abuse? How much of a challenge is that to Catholic doctrine and practice?
I think it's a major challenge, and I think we've already seen that in reactions from Archbishop Hart as president of the Episcopal Conference and from people like Frank Brennan, the Jesuit. But It has been already legislated in Ireland, and there are various states in the United States where there's similar legislation. I think the church has to grapple with the realities behind the Royal Commission, and it has to grapple with the history. And the Royal Commission report talks about one incident in history where the church allowed priests to break the seal, and that was in 1477 in the French Gallican Church, where Louis XI decreed that everyone, including priests, were under pain of death to report any plot against the king or the state. And reluctantly, the theologians and canon lawyers agreed to that. The second case in church history was in 1755 by Pope Benedict XIV, who allowed the priest who heard the confession of a person who was being considered for canonization after their death. And that was allowed up until 1917 with the 1917 Code of Canon Law. The history of confession is a very different one. In the early centuries, it was public confession where there was no issue about secrecy, and gradually it shifted by the time of Augustine. Private confession was in, and then particularly from the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215, there was this emphasis on the seal of confession.
What about this debate that's now going on as to whether a victim of sexual abuse, or indeed a victim of any serious crime, who mentions in the confession to the priest that they have been a victim, are they covered by the seal of confession? Because there seems to be some disagreement even among archbishops and bishops about this.
Yeah, there's a significant disagreement, as we saw on the last day of the Catholic wrap-up of the Royal Commission in February. If a child discloses, and not confesses, because that's the wrong word, discloses that they have been abused by an adult, a priest, or a relative, then according to some, that's not covered by the seal. The seal is to do with the actual sins that are confessed by the penitent. So there is a dispute there, but I think the recent tradition is that all aspects of the confession, disclosures, etc., are covered by the seal of confession, but that is now being seriously challenged.
Now, just finally, Des, the Anglican Church, where, if you like, one-on-one confession is very unusual, there is a communal form of confession during the service, they have voted to allow that secrecy to be broken in certain circumstances. What do they allow?
Well, they allow for to interact with the penitent, and if it's a very serious sin, to go with them to the authorities, and if they refuse to do that, then they're at liberty to report the matter to the authorities. And this goes back to that within the history of confession, the Royal Commission quotes Bertrand Kirchide, the very question, how can the obligation of the seal be reconciled with the precept of charity, which mandates that we should shield our neighbour against physical and spiritual injury to the best of our ability? And even Aquinas conceded that a priest, his confessions, can take preventative measures to stop what he called an impending calamity.
RMIT Professor Des Carl and the five-year-long study that he's co-authored into the sexual abuse crisis will be released by RMIT in September. There's an extended interview with Des on our website. You're with Andrew West. You've heard the stories. They're powerful, moving, certainly hard to miss. Domestic violence in some religious communities, women banned from the priesthood, even from preaching, the insistence that the pious Jewish or Muslim woman must cover her hair or even her face. Surely then religion's bad for women. And yet, The National Church Life Survey has shown that women make up 60% of worshippers, sometimes more. So what draws women to faith and organized religion? And is it secularism that's failing them? Dr. Erin Wilson is an Australian researcher. She runs the Centre for Religion, Conflict and the Public Domain at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. She's been in Australia on a speaking tour.
There's a big debate in particularly humanitarian circles around women's rights and gender equality about whether religion is good or bad for women and we should be promoting secular values because secularism is better for women's equality. But I think it's asking the question in the wrong way because it's either religion or it's secularism. But if we look at both contexts, women's equality is far from being achieved.
Yeah, in a recent essay for International Women's Day, you were in no hurry, Erin, to exonerate secularism as being better for women's equality. Why is that?
Well, if you think about secular systems of governance, I mean, women have only had the vote for a little over 100 years. Rates of pay equity across numerous different secular contexts are far from being achieved. Women are still being judged on their appearance and the way that they speak and the way that they dress far more than men when they hold public office. Percentages of women in parliament, in positions of leadership, in professorships within university are incredibly low. And these are all what we would term secular institutions. There's even been incidences of women being sent home from their job without pay for refusing to wear high heels in the workplace.
Yes, that's an interesting case. You cite that in an example in your essay. That's, I think, a big bank in London or the United States, wasn't it?
It was in London, yes. It was May of last year that this girl turned up to work wearing flat shoes, and the firm told her she had to go and buy a pair of high heels, and she refused, and they sent her home without pay. I mean, that's just a clear example of gender inequality, and these are secular institutions that we're looking at.
The debate in Australia in the last couple of weeks has really focused on the theology of evangelical conservative Protestantism. I mean, do you acknowledge that there are some issues where scripture, and not just in evangelical Protestantism, but obviously in Islam, would appear to be very discriminatory if they're read in certain ways against women?
Yes, I think you can definitely make that argument. And I mean, it's happening, but that doesn't itself make the religion inherently bad for women. Mm. It's interpretations of religious traditions and interpretations of religious texts that are being used in particular ways. But we see that also with, you know, it used to happen in science as well, that women were argued to have lower intelligence, smaller brains, and that made them less fit for participating in public life. This isn't a new argument or a new approach. It's something that's been around for a long time.
You take on in this essay that you wrote earlier this year, and we'll put a link to that on our website, the French fixation on the burkini, which is the sort of coverall swimming costume for women. At one point, I suspect, in the suffragettes movement and the women's liberation movement, it was not revealing the body. Now it seems, you know, the argument about being a real woman in France is that you reveal as much as possible.
That's definitely what's happening. In France, it's very much about making assumptions about the burkini itself, and they're assuming that these women are being forced to cover up. That's the basic point of this position within France. And that's why they're saying, well, you can't wear this. But it's neglecting to take into consideration the women themselves, and that the women themselves, in many cases, are actually choosing to wear this. And that's the problem, is that this position of the French government on this is assuming the role of defender of women's rights without actually speaking to the women about it themselves. The problem, though, of course, is also that the burkini has come to be associated with and symbolise, in some respects, this kind of fundamentalist Islam that is causing so many problems within a lot of European societies. And so at the time, the argument by the French government was that this not only did this represent the oppression of women, but it raised concerns for the French public. Just coming so quickly after the lorry attack in Nice, the burkini saga was raising tensions for the French public, making French citizens uncomfortable. And that was the argument of the government as to why it shouldn't be allowed to be worn in public.
You're in Australia to deliver a series of lectures on the question of religion and the refugee crisis. How have we conflated the terms refugee, Muslim, and then terrorist?
Since the early 2000s, and particularly since 9/11, we've had these kind of concurrent crises emerge, if you like. We've had the refugee crisis, where we have, you know, displacement on unforeseen levels. And at the same time, we have this growing concern with terrorism and violent extremism.
Which are real things. I mean, you don't deny that they exist.
No, of course not. Of course not. But one of the problems with the violent extremism narrative is that the focus is very heavily on the Muslim community and often ignores or downplays the fact that there are all different sorts of violent extremism, including white nationalist, Christian violent extremism, Hindu and Buddhist violent extremism in a lot of different societies as well. So there's that discourse that's emerging. And then on the other hand, we have this refugee crisis where the majority of people who are being displaced are coming from countries where Islam is the dominant religion and also colours the kind of cultural and political milieu of these countries. There's this assumption that's made that most refugees are Muslim. And then it's only a short step where on the other side you have this assumption that all Muslims are terrorists, and then the two become conflated, particularly when you have this mass movement of people that states are struggling to control because there's very few safe legal pathways available to them. And so people are taking things into their own hands. The state then creates this narrative of chaos and uncontrolled borders. And then it becomes a security threat. We don't know who's coming through. There could be potential terrorists. Then you end up with this mess of Muslim, terrorist and refugee.
And you also take on the idea that all Muslim refugees are essentially religious, that it's the most important thing in their character. Mm-hmm. And I think you've said that it can lead to mistakes being made in resettlement. And you give the example even in Canada, which is now held up as this sort of sanctified place of compassion. And even Canada's made some mistakes, assuming that religion is the most important characteristic for refugees.
Yeah, there's been some research done by Laurie Beeman, heading up a team at the University of Ottawa, where they've looked at refugees who are being resettled in Canada and also the broader Muslim community and kind of assumptions that are made about them. In Canada, the assessment for where to place some refugees has been done by looking at towns saying, well, do they have a mosque? Is there somewhere for the refugees to go to worship? A lot of refugees aren't Muslim, for starters. Even if they are Muslim, being able to go to mosque is not necessarily their first concern. It will be for some, but it won't be for all of them. For a lot of them, it's more about shelter and about food and about being able to send their kids to school and having somewhere to live and all these other kinds of things. We tend to prioritise the religious identity of refugees. And then on that basis, because this religious identity is entangled with this discourse on terrorism, we then turn refugees into security threats. I do make the argument we need to really rethink these kinds of assumptions that we're making about refugees and their identities and the importance of religion in that. And we should actually be asking them, what is it you need? What is the most important thing for you when you arrive, when you're resettled, for you to feel safe and for you to be able to contribute to your new society?
Dr. Erin Wilson of the Centre for Religion, Conflict and the Public Domain at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, ending today's Religion and Ethics Report. You can download all our interviews at our homepage on the RN website. Find us on iTunes. Thanks to Nadia Telgourley, David Lawford and Jolan Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.